Welcome to this University of Warwick podcast on turmoil in the Eurozone, whose crisis? My name is Ben Richardson. I'm a lecturer in the Department of Politics and International Studies at the University of Warwick. And today I'm joined by two esteemed scholars in the field of international political economy to discuss this issue. The first is Professor Brigitte Jung at the University of Munster, and the second is Professor Magnus Reiner at Oxford Brookes University. Asking the questions will be two doctoral students in the department here at Warwick, Ben Brown and Maya Savevska. So, Maya, if you'd like to take us away with the first question, please.
Professor Jung, you have acknowledged that Germany was able to profit from its current account surpluses, which in turn makes it part of the problem of the budget deficit of many Eurozone countries. Will the strengthened coordination of fiscal and economic policy envisaged with the six-pack reform under the new European semester somewhat resolve the problem of uneven development within the Eurozone, which itself derogates from the standards of optimal currency area?
Very interesting question. At one level, it is welcome that we finally have at the European level, with the introduction of the six-pack at the European Parliament, that we have, in fact, more coordination, the emphasis on more economic coordination. But if we actually look at the six-pack, what does the six-pack do? It does less in terms of economic coordination. It is the centerpiece is to fine governments for excessive debts. So actually it is to toughen fiscal rules, and that is not going to solve the problem. And as you pointed out, what we have in the Eurozone, particularly since the introduction of the euro, we have the German very high trade surpluses, also with the countries of Austria, Holland and Finland. But of the 250 billions of surpluses, Germany alone has 185. So it's really Germany, the country which counts. And you see at the same time, the absolute deficit, the current account deficit of many of the peripheral countries. And what does that mean? You have, at one time, the Germans are selling their cars, they're selling their chemicals, they are selling their machine tools to the periphery. And so Germany has surpluses and the other countries have deficits because they are buying the goods. So you have these macroeconomic imbalances. And these macroeconomic imbalances are neither, in fact, discussed in a six-pack or the fiscal pact, which was just, in fact, agreed upon last Friday. And in fact, the macroeconomic balances, imbalances to me, are one of the important aspects. Unless we resolve it, we cannot resolve it by simply focusing on tightening whatever the fiscal rules. Because as Keynes has pointed out in 1944, what we have to do, we have also to get the surplus countries into these management or these, in fact, asymmetries, which we have in order to manage them properly. At this point, it is only, or the entire onus is on the deficit countries. They have to adjust, but not the surplus countries. And that is an article, a wonderful article by my colleague Kenneth Dyson, who in fact has written about it. It has to do with power. In 1945, the Americans had the power, and they had surpluses in terms of, and they refused to have the surpluses discussed. Now, in the Eurozone, it is the Germans who have the surpluses, and they will not discuss it. Coming back, the six-pack, it is an important item that we finally start to discuss economic coordination, but it will not resolve the problem of macroeconomic imbalances.
Professor Jung, you have advocated the view that the accumulation regime of the boom years prior to the financial crisis is best described as a form of privatized Keynesianism, where private indebtedness substitutes for public debt in maintaining a sufficient level of aggregate demand. One of the drawbacks of this regime is that it increases inequality rather than reducing it. In your view, what are the implications of current reforms of EU governance and the structural reforms in the deficit countries for inequality and the regime of privatized Keynesianism?
Well, have we had any reforms in the Eurozone? I see the only thing in terms of the German position is in terms of more tough and fiscal rules. So that has been the overriding emphasis. And in fact, this privatized Keynesianism comes really from Colin Crouch, who in fact talked about that after World War II, there were two regimes or accumulation regimes. The one was the state Keynesianism, where you had wages tied to productivity and you had a welfare system. And if you had, in fact, economic downturns, the state either would reduce taxes or increase spending. Then, after Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, after 1979, 1980, we had, in terms of the delegitimization of the state, whilst the state is the problem, not the answer anymore, that much more the emphasis was on private, and particularly that, in fact, demand was created through private debt that people in the United States, in Great Britain, in fact, invested in their homes and used the collateral for consumption purposes. That was really the idea, and we know what happened with the subprime, that we had the crisis. So creating tremendous inequality when we look in those countries, for example, the United States and Great Britain, with the private debt structure, we have huge discrepancy between the rich and the poor. What do we have right now? This is a third system, and that is we have deleveraging, meaning the state, in fact, as we know, in fact, has problems, has high deficits. The companies, as well as the private sector, the banks have deficits, and the household has deficits as well. And so what we are really going into a deflationary spiral. We see that in Greece, there's a very high downturn of the economy from 6% to 8%. We see that in Spain. We see that in Portugal. But also, not only those countries, we have also had last year already a decline in terms of Germany from the year before. So in fact, what we need to think really about what can be a fourth regime. So it's not deleveraging once we get out of it. And that is, how do we create growth which is both sustainable, socially fair, and ecologically sustainable? Because both privatized Keynesianism and state Keynesianism focused on growth. And I don't think we can really have a system just in terms of growth. Environmentalism, if, for example, the Chinese would have as many cars in Beijing alone as we have or the United States has, the planet would not survive. So the idea is really to construct a different model, and we do not have it at this point, okay, which is socially fair but also environmentally sustainable, and define growth differently. Define growth as the Stiglitz Commission has tried to do, in terms to think, how do you measure GDP, you know, in terms of life quality, in terms of other aspects and not just growth. Because in a country, if you build prisons, it goes into the calculation of the GDP and you have an increase of growth. But is that really a valuable growth? Okay, so we really need to think in broader terms, but at this point it is something we are still looking for reforms, and the EU at this point, unfortunately, has their single focus has been toughened fiscal rules, and that comes mostly from Germany.
You have recently published two edited volumes with a focus on gender in international political economy. In which ways can a gender perspective contribute to our understanding of what is currently happening in Europe in the fields of financial regulation and macroeconomic governance?
Well, an interesting question. Gender, when we look at the studies, there have been a lot of studies already since the Asian crisis. But what gender has done, they looked at the effects of the financial crisis on women, or particularly also the poor in developing countries. Gender has not engaged with the financial market. What's the dynamic of the market? What do derivatives have to do, currency systems, what do they have to do with gender? So actually, to deconstruct the market from a gender perspective has not been done. And despite the fact that I published these edited volumes, and particularly one questioning financial governance from a feminist perspective, there are only feminist economists who wrote, but we all are somewhat critical, even of our own work, because economics, the economists, even if they have a feminist training, come out of microeconomics. That's the training. And so you have a methodological individualism. But in terms of macro, it doesn't get you to the macro level, right? So even in feminist economics has not been able really to go further and, in fact, open up the macroeconomics in terms of monetary system, in terms of how the markets really work. And I do not believe and very strongly disagree with the gender studies which try to show that women are more risk adverse. These studies, in fact, the few studies which exist, take women who have a very small portfolio. Meaning, if you have a small portfolio, of course you are more risk-averse because you're afraid to lose people who are your investors, all right? Also, if you compare the amount of money these are managed in these portfolios, they're extraordinarily small. They're 3% of the entire volumes of, in fact, portfolios which women manage. Well, out of that, you can really not draw a conclusion. And my interest is much more, not so much in terms of women to talk about, but diversity. We know one thing, and even at the World Economic Forum, in 2009, it was interesting that one of the best panels was, I only saw it on television, I was not invited there, was on, would the Lehman sisters have done something different? And the answer was, so even the biggest and the best and the brightest in finance asked this question. And they came to the conclusion, what needs to be done, in fact, is to open the very self-referential, very self-contained system. We need more diversity. What do we have in terms of finance? We have an epistemic community. Many have written on Eric Helleiner, also Eleni Zinger, have pointed out that we have this structure which people in terms of finance come from the same social background. They have the same elite education. And interesting enough, you talk to people from Korea. They also go to the United States and go to schools such as Chicago. So they all come out more or less of the same background. They believed very strongly in the efficient market hypothesis. And very strongly, the basis was the mathematical models and a self-referential system. Now, that model, as we know, led to the crisis. And so I think most of us, and even financial analysts, agree what needs to be done. We really need to open it up, and there comes gender into it. But I would even say small, medium and small businesses, people from developing countries, need to have an input to really base finance again on the real economy. So yes, gender is one aspect of it, but it will not resolve, unfortunately, women will not solve the world's problem.
Professor Reiner, first question for you. You have put forward a very powerful thesis about the subordination of Europe's economy to the minimal US hegemony. How has the recent economic crisis affected the EU position vis-à-vis the States, which despite the crisis appears to be able to pursue expansionary macroeconomic policies that enable it to get to its pre-crisis GDP level, unlike the Eurozone countries? But despite its relative strength, has the EU structural power declined in the post-crisis period?
Okay, well, that's an excellent question. I mean, this is coming, the sort of this thesis you're mentioning comes from a book, Europe at Bay, that came out in 2007 that I wrote with Alan Cafruni. And, I mean, what we were targeting primarily there was a set of arguments that were around in the mid-2000s that made extravagant claims about the creation of the euro will make Europe a superpower that will challenge US hegemony and so on and so forth. So the main The main object of that book was to show the fallacies of that. I mean, there was a more subtle argument. For example, people like Eric Jones have made that argument, that the euro provided a kind of a way for Europe to shelter some of the side effects that come from the Americans displacing externalities on the rest of the world through their macroeconomic adjustment or lack of macroeconomic adjustment. And I mean, there is a grain of truth to that, but we also suggested that those arguments profoundly underestimated the costs that were entailed in creating the euro, and particularly something that relates to the whole question of institutional embeddedness, as a matter of fact, and that is the lack of institutional complementarity between what we broadly can call global financial markets and Europe's particular institutional sets of corporate governance, as well as the institutional configurations of the everyday in Europe that is particularly structured through the welfare state and the societal accords that were related to that. In the United States, you have a complementarity between global finance, a highly securitized form of corporate governance, and also the use of private everyday finance to fund housing and pensions and so on and so forth. And we pointed out was that the EMU very much underestimated the possibilities of institutionalizing this in Europe. And I think that coming directly to your question, and I think actually this remains the case. I think actually some of the things we are talking about in terms of the restructurings that are taking place in Europe right now in terms of, and the protests around trying to sort of challenge the welfare state, sort of implement, how indicate of how profound these tensions are still in Europe. So, I think one thing is for sure, and that is that the financial crisis has not put us in a situation where the euro will challenge the dollar. What would be a very interesting research question, and one that I hope to contribute to in the future, is whether we are in a situation where the creation of the euro has done enough in terms of providing savers and financial managers with exits out of the US dollar so that the Americans can no longer, as Benjamin Cohen suggests, deflect and delay adjustments. And we may find ourselves finally in a situation where we have no hegemony at all, and we could have potentially a Kindlebergian situation like in the 1930s. And that is, as we know, a very, very dangerous situation. But I think that the jury is still very much out, and I don't think that it would be wise to predict, because quite a lot of these things will also depend on agency and subjectivity, and there are things that the Americans could do that I think structurally the Europeans is a lot more difficult to do. So the jury is out on that one, but I think for sure it won't be a European century.
Oh, thanks for the answer. And the second question, it appears as though the crisis, instead of providing a fertile ground for a U-turn in the policies of competitive austerity, has instead exacerbated the problem. The Euro Plus Pact furthered the flexibilization of wage relations. Moreover, the EU seems to be resolute in its dedication to modernizing the welfare state, which translates into a commodification of welfare provision, as evident in the 2020 strategy, the successor of the Lisbon Agenda. How sustainable is this trend of further constitutionalization of the fiscal rectitude evident in the new fiscal compact signed just last week at the European Summit in Brussels?
Again, it's a very good question, and I also completely agree with your characterization of the broad trend. I looked at the text of the fiscal compact as it was signed at the end of January and then has been recently ratified. And, you know, if you look at Article 5 in the fiscal compact, I mean, basically, by setting a deficit normal deficit target on 0.5% that only at the moment Finland and Estonia is meeting, you're pretty much creating a state of exception in all European states, where if they are actually going to follow the letter, you more or less cede right to set economic policy to the Troika and the Council of Ministers. And these, in Orwellesque terms, economic partnership programs say that when you get to the excessive deficit procedure, these economic partnership programs should have detailed agreements on not only macroeconomic reform, but also structural reform. And this should be agreed by all parties concerned, and it is to be enshrined in EU law so that the Commission or any other member state can take another state to the court if they do not comply to their economic partnership program. And it's quite clear where the sort of structural policy is taking us. It's taking us exactly in that direction. Is this sustainable? Well, I think that we have had a very, very peculiar period in Europe the last 2 years. Last 2 years has created a very, very peculiar conjuncture where the North has temporarily been able to sort of return to strong growth, start to get macroeconomic balance, and all of a sudden has been possible to understand and create a common sense about the crisis as essentially being reduced to irresponsible public spending in the South. This sort of recovery has been based on a highly fragile export-led demand coming from emerging markets that is not sustainable, that has been taken over the slack of the privatized Keynesian regime in the United States that, of course, we know is in question. And it is very, very questionable whether this system is actually, or this 2 years recovery is actually sustainable. I mean, this sort of scope for aggregate demand pull of the European North is probably going to run into limits. And where is demand going to come from then? That, I think, is a huge question. So, yes, I very much question that it is a sustainable strategy. It seems to me like we have a situation where, as they used to say about the last Bourbon king of France, that they have forgotten nothing and they have learned nothing. Because on the other side, what is going on here is that we have the infusion of money from the European Central Bank that has to find some way of making return by finding some way of leveraging itself. And where is it going to go unless it's going to go into very, very risky investment propositions?
Okay, the last question for today. Many observers agree that the debt crisis was ultimately caused by the massive current account imbalances within the euro area, and Professor Young has just talked about this. This has provoked a new debate about the sustainability of the German export-oriented growth model.
Mm.
And while this model serves managers and shareholders well, the requirement of low, very low wages diminishes wage earners' purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this crisis might provide an incentive for social democracy, especially in Germany, to turn its back on third-way-style neoliberalism and to advocate the strengthening of domestic demand through higher wages?
I think, actually, that there are signs of a change of thinking in certain circles. For example, in the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, I am myself involved in a project that is partly sponsored by the Northern Office of the Friedrich Ebert Foundation in Stockholm that is looking at the political economy of falling wage shares. And basically you have people also sort of connected to that thinking of the Friedrich Ebert Foundation is post-Keynesian economists such as Hans-Jörg Herr. And I think that they problematize and they see problems in very, very similar ways, actually, to the way that Professor Young responded to the first question. Other examples of that is also from the German Left Party and the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, also many of whom have been involved in the Euro Memorandum group. So I think actually there are sort of signs of problematization in certain intellectual circles that are in some ways affiliated with the German Social Democratic and the German Left Party. And I think that there's also perhaps a sign of what is good about the fiscal compact is to be starting to actually think about the European economy as a large continental integral economy. We have to understand the interconnections. So that is the positive sign, but not really, because what is also very, very striking is how marginal these voices are and what a strong disjuncture there is between these foundations and the actual practical political thinking within the parties themselves. And I mean, the German Social Democratic Party is at the forefront. I mean, they, as I understand it, in Germany, the whole idea of the fiscal compact comes from a proposition of a change in the basic law in Germany, where budget deficits are going to be constitutionally illegal. You know, to actually change things would require a very, very radical change of thinking in Germany. And this is in a society where you do have an economic base that is very, very particular and based on a large export-oriented investment goods companies operating in markets with very, very low price elasticity, which means that, you know, they are not particularly bothered by high value of a euro anyway. And as a result, it is very, very straightforward in Germany at the moment to score political points by reducing the whole question in populist terms to a problem with the Greeks and selling Greek islands and all that kind of stuff. So I think that any sort of move towards that in the short term in Germany would, you know, any political party that would do it at very, very high cost. And it hasn't really, you know, the ideological terrain has not been cultivated at all for that. Now, that being said, I mean, I looked into this back in 1998 and tried to sort of make sense of the La Fontaine movement in 1998. And I mean, I found, and I think that that is true, that the monetary union is also creating problems within Germany, in particular the reunified Germany, of trying to maintain broad social political alliances between those who are unemployed, East Germans, middle classes, people working in the sort of Mittelstand export sector in Baden-Württemberg. And it is becoming increasingly difficult in a globalized world with globalized finance, integrated Europe, to maintain these alliances. And actually, if you look at both the Social Democratic and the Christian Democratic parties in Germany, find it increasingly difficult to do that. And the overall vote for these parties have actually been reduced over a long term. And I thought, well, maybe this might be the beginning of some kind of thinking, but I don't think so at all. And in any case, it seems to me right now there seems to be less prospect of that than there were in 1998.
Professor Magnus Reiner, thanks for that. We seem to end on a similar note. We opened up possibilities for change and then closed them down a little, but you know, such is the way of a critical political economist. But I'd like to thank you, Professor Brigitte Jung, and also Ben and Maya for asking the questions, and thank you for listening.